From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a fistful of dollars for a few dollars more, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Has Sergio Leone revived the Western and made a star of Clint Eastwood? We talk with Christopher Frayling about his new book and museum exhibition, Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone. Frayling is also chair of the Arts Council of England. Also, Joe Strummer pre-Clash. Milo Miles takes us back to the days when Strummer called himself Woody and played in a band called the 101ers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, just back from vacation. My thanks to Dave Davies for hosting while I was gone. Well, this is a fun show to return to. A Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Once Upon a Time in the West. Today we talk about the westerns by the Italian director Sergio Leone. His brutal westerns revived the genre, made a movie star of Clint Eastwood, created a visual style that influenced many film directors around the world, and introduced many of us to the film music of Ennio Morricone. Leone was born in 1929 and died in 1989. He described himself as growing up in the cinema. Both his parents had worked in movies. But his own movies from the 60s got very little respect in their own time. They were disparagingly called spaghetti westerns. My guest, Christopher Frayling, is one of the world's leading experts on Leone. He's the chair of the Arts Council of England and rector at London's Royal College of Art. He's written a new book called Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone. It's a companion to the new exhibition of the same name that he co-curated at the Autry National Center's Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. You've spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about Sergio Leone. Why is he so worthy of time and study?
Well, I first saw his first Western, A Fistful of Dollars, in 1967 when I was at college, and it blew me away. The style of it, the music, the look, the different approach to the hero, a whole series of elements were very, very different. And yet all the newspapers were saying this film was terrible, it was an ersatz version of an American Western, it wasn't worth seeing. So it started off as a crusade to try and persuade people to go and see this movie. Like all cult movies, you try and spread the word and try and convert people to it. And I guess, you know, 40 years later, the world's caught up with me because people treat these films with great respect and interest.
What's a scene from Leone's first Western, A Fistful of Dollars, that you loved in 1967 when you first saw it and that you still love now that you could describe for us?
Gosh. Four or five bad guys sitting on a five-bar gate in the main street of a fly-blown Spanish town standing in for a northern Mexican town. And the man with no name, the hero, walks up to them, and there's this satisfying sort of crunch on the soundtrack as his boots walk down the main street and lots of dust. And they start, in true macho style, they start abusing each other. And they start laughing at him. And he looks down and lights his cigarillo and says, my mule don't like you laughing. He gets the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you just apologize to my mule. And then there's silence and there's a whirring sound on the soundtrack. And you get the eyes and you get the puff of smoke and suddenly an explosion and all five bad guys fall off the five-bar gate. It's a sort of parody of the Western confrontation. It's so extreme and very, very stylish. And it was the first really big close-up of the young Clint Eastwood, who was fantastically good-looking in those days, only with a designer stubble smoking a cheroot with his eyes screwed up as he looked into the sun. It's a very memorable moment. It's stayed with me ever since.
Well, I think we should hear that scene because it's classic Clint Eastwood talking between his teeth. So here's that scene that you're talking about, and the explosion that we hear at the end is him shooting all those guys who are waiting for him.
Adios, amigo.
Listen, stranger. Didn't you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
You see, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you went and fired those shots at his feet.
Hey, you making some kind of joke?
No. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the muley just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize.
I don't think it's nice you laughing. See, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
That's a scene from Sergio Leone's first Western, A Fistful of Dollars, and my guest, Christopher Frayling, is the author of the new book, Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone, and he's also the co-curator of an exhibit called Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone, and that's at the Museum of the American West. Why did Sergio Leone love Westerns? Why did he want to make them in Italy?
Well, you've got to imagine a child growing up in 1930s Rome at a time when Mussolini was the dictator and when most American movies were banned and those that were seen were dubbed into Italian. And the young Leone first saw his Hollywood Western movies in the 1930s at that time, and his heroes were Gary Cooper and Clark Gable and films like Stagecoach. And to him, they represented an absolute model of freedom. He lived in suburban Rome in cramped conditions, and he saw these wide open spaces, this unimaginable desert that goes on forever. He saw these characters. He couldn't understand what they were saying. He never heard In fact, he never learned to speak English, Sergio Leone. That's what's so extraordinary. But they were dubbed into a different language, not very well. But nevertheless, they clicked in his mind. Then, in the 1950s, when he went into the film industry, he found that nobody was really very interested in the Western. A lot of Hollywood veteran directors went over to Italy to make epics, films like Ben-Hur and Helen of Troy and Quo Vadis. And Leone hung around these films. Sometimes he was the assistant director. And he talked to directors like Fred Zinnemann, who'd made High Noon, Robert Aldrich, who'd made The Last Sunset and Apache and films like that. And they all said to him, the Western's dead. It's finished. We don't make Westerns anymore. So basically, Leone made Westerns because Hollywood had stopped making them and because in Europe, and particularly in Italy, there was this huge interest in the Western and a huge knowledge of it as well. So the whole thing starts in a kind of folk memory of American Westerns that went back to the 1930s, and it's partly political. But the other thing was that Leone felt that Westerns had got a bit talky. There was too much talking in them. He liked Westerns where Rin Tin Tin did all the thinking, you know. Old-fashioned Westerns where lots and lots of action and not too much talk. He didn't like psychology. You know, Freudian Westerns got on his nerves. Films like The Left-Handed Gun with Paul Newman, where, you know, you feel if there'd been a social worker around, Billy the Kid would never have happened. Films like that, he didn't like. He liked films where, you know, a lot of shooting, a lot of riding, a lot of action, a lot of landscape. So he wanted to bring back the kind of innocence of the Western. It had become too sophisticated.
Well, you know, but he knew he was making Westerns that were different from American ones. Like he said, and I think this was to you that he said this in your interview with him, that John Ford, the great director of Westerns, was full of optimism, whereas I, on the contrary, am full of pessimism.
Well, that's the thing. He loved the look of the Western and the idea of the Western and the fairy tale of the Western, but he didn't like some of the ideologies. He didn't like John Wayne very much. And some of the sort of crusading element of the Western that you got in 50s and early 60s Westerns. So loved the visuals, didn't like the ideology very much. So he takes the concept of the Western and makes it much, much more cynical. I mean, the hero, for example, when people ask him, why are you doing this for us? As someone actually asks in A Fistful of Dollars, the first of his Westerns, why are you doing this for us? Instead of saying, you know, because a man's got to do what a man's got to do, or there's some things a man can't just ride around, things like that, that he says, $500? He works strictly for ready cash. So he has a very streetwise 1960s cash-only attitude to life. And this was a very different kind of hero, much more grown-up kind of hero to the old-fashioned crusading hero. And I think that the modern movie action hero begins with the Clint Eastwood character in A Fistful of Dollars, where you identify with the hero not because of what he believes in anymore, because he doesn't actually believe in anything. You identify with him because of his style, you know, the way he wears his clothes, the way he walks, the personal style of the man. And that, of course, is the basis of identification of all modern action heroes. And I think it begins with Clint Eastwood in A Fistful of Dollars.
Well, you know, in American Westerns, the good guys were usually, you know, relatively clean-looking and attractive in a movie star, you know, kind of way. In Leone movies, they're so violent. And everyone in it, you know, the bad guys and the guys who are relatively good guys, and nobody's exactly good guy in the American movie Western way, they're all, like, dirty, grizzled, and mean.
I know, it's true. It's true. And the production design, this sort of... the towns look very lived in. Leone couldn't bear those overlit towns you get in TV westerns. There were a lot, of course, in the 1950s and early 60s, there were lots and lots of TV westerns. In England, you know, every night on every channel, there was a different western series. And they were all very well scrubbed and well lit, and they looked as though they were shot on a back lot in Hollywood. And Leone detested that look. He wanted to, you know, dirty it up a bit, make it more grungy. So the towns look lived in, and the hats are all grey hats. They're not black hats or white hats, they're grey hats. Lots of dust, lots of designer stubble. Everyone looks as though they haven't washed for 3 weeks. And actually, if you look at archive photos of the historical West, I think his look was closer, historically, to what it was actually like, to those Hollywood movies of the 50s and 60s. You know, everyone looks very kind of dirty, and they have bad teeth, and they haven't shaved, and their skin isn't, as you'd expect, isn't in very good condition. They didn't have access to healthcare. So in a funny way, he's doing quite a lot of historical research and looking at lots of archive photos. He had a vast collection of archive photos, and I've traced some of the visual influences and visual inspirations for his films in archive photos. So in a funny way, he's doing a lot of research, but it's kind of a well-researched dream, you could say. So he's creating a kind of dream world, a fairy tale world, but the surface of it looks very, very realistic.
Another convention that Leone breaks is, you know, you don't shoot children in cold blood in the great American westerns. I think I'm right in saying that.
Yeah, you certainly are.
Yeah. And at the beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West, the bad guys, and the lead bad guy is Henry Fonda, you know, Mr. American icon. The bad guys come in to this little deserted cabin in the desert, shoot up the whole family. One boy survives, and Henry Fonda looks at him, talks to him, and then shoots him in cold blood. And I don't think you would have seen that in an American movie, and you certainly wouldn't have seen Henry Fonda doing that.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, in American TV versions of Once Upon a Time in the West, that moment was cut. American TV audiences weren't ready for Henry Fonda doing such a dreadful thing, it was assumed at that time. I mean, the whole thing was that Leone loved casting against type. You know, he imagined that the audience had a memory in their heads of every performance that Henry Fonda had given. Here's the man who'd played young Mr. Lincoln, Frank James. He'd played Wyatt Earp. He'd played one of John Ford's heroes. This was the all-American hero. Who better to cast as a psychopathic, child-killing gunslinger? And Leone's great story was that Henry Fonda arrived on the set with brown contact lenses to cover his bright blue eyes and a dark stubble, because he thought bad guys had stubble and brown eyes. And Leone said, "You're missing the point." Or he said through his interpreter, "You're missing the point, Hank. The whole point is you've got to have those translucent blue eyes. You've got to be clean shaven. And you make your first appearance and the camera's just behind you at shoulder level. And it comes round to see you as you come out of the bushes, and your cheek is puffed out with a wad of tobacco. And the camera comes round to show your face. And I want everybody in the audience to say, 'Jesus Christ, it's Henry Fonda.'" And that's exactly what happened. Everyone is the last person in the world you'd expect in that situation. So partly a cinematic thing's going on, partly because in a Western universe where everyone's bad, there are some people who are very, very bad. In a Leone's universe, if you do nasty things to children, you are very, very bad. So the way to show the really bad guy, where everyone's wearing a grey hat, is that something horrible like the massacre of a family. Actually, there's quite a traditional morality underneath that. It's just that he's ratcheted up the odds a little bit more.
My guest is Christopher Frayling, author of a new book and co-curator of a new museum exhibition about the westerns of Sergio Leone. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Frayling. He co-curated the new exhibition Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone, which is at the Autry National Center's Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. Now, we are recording this shortly after the terrorist attacks in London. And so, you know, we're talking about, like, the aesthetics of violence in Sergio Leone's movies at a time when, you know, London, your home, has been hit with genuine, real violence. Does it make you lose your taste, at least temporarily, for the violence in Leone's movies? Or can you hold both of those thoughts in your minds at the same time? You know, that real violence is horrible, and Sergio Leone movies are really great.
Oh, that's a very, very interesting question. I mean, I think you have to hold on to the thought there is a fundamental difference between art and life. Things go on in art, in film, in painting, in theatre, in dance, in music. And they're in a sort of parallel universe to the everyday world of existence. I think that's the first thing. And once you forget that, you're in deep trouble because you're into areas of censorship, freedom of speech, you know, all sorts of limits put onto the arts because they're in some way supposed to reflect on or have an influence on everyday life. So I hold on to that thought. There is a separation. They are different things. You know, a broadcast is not real life. At the same time, there's the area of taste and there's the area which we've talked about a crusading element. I find violence associated with a crusading element, with a set of extreme beliefs, very, very distasteful in whatever art form I see it. It makes me extremely uncomfortable to watch or listen to things where we're supposed to think that extreme violence is a good thing. Or
give me an example of the kind of movie you mean there.
Take the traditional Hollywood Western, where the contact between the white settlers and the Native Americans is, in early Westerns, completely unproblematic. The white guys are the good guys, and they have every right to shoot any Native American they see, because basically the Native Americans are in the way, and the white guys have a claim to the land which they have a manifest destiny. They have a right to the land on which the Native American stands. And there's a feeling of, you know, their right to do this, so we shouldn't be worried about another Native American biting the dust. Now, that changed in the 1950s and 60s, where movies got more complicated as society got more complicated and got more sophisticated. But early Westerns are really quite heavy, are quite difficult to watch from that. I don't like movies like that. I really don't. They upset me because there's a belief system and a set of ideologies associated with the violence, which is taken for granted. You assume the audience, it has the same belief system as the white guys. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Today, we have a more multicultural approach, thank goodness, a more sophisticated approach. And we don't like that kind of basic fundamentalist assumption about violence. And so movies have got more complicated. I don't think the Italian Westerns fit into that category at all. There isn't a racial quality to the violence. There isn't an ideological quality. There isn't a crusading quality. It's not associated with fundamentalist beliefs. It's like a comic. And for me, therefore, it's quite possible to hold in one's head a love of these movies. And some of them, you know, there were 400 Italian Westerns made, roughly 400 Italian Westerns made between the mid-60s and the early 70s. Some of them are terrible, you know. Quite a lot of them are terrible. Very violent, very brutal, and nothing else. It's just a kind of bloodbath. It's like going to the Colosseum, I imagine, to see some gladiatorial thing for 90 minutes. But some of them, and I would include The Good, the Bad and the Ugly and Once Upon a Time in the West, are wonderful, wonderful movies. They're up there with the greatest movies of all time, particularly Once Upon a Time in the West. The first 10 minutes of Once Upon a Time in the West, for me, is one of the most sublime 10 minutes in the history of the movies. And I can hold that idea in my head very, very easily, whilst also thinking about these dreadful atrocities that have happened in everyday life. I don't see the connection.
Sergio Leone made genre films, but he really was, in his own way, an art director. You know, he could have almost been a film critic, judging from your interview with him. He knew so much about cinema and was so alert to its subtleties. He knew exactly what he was doing in his movies. There's a lot of thinking, a lot of intellectualism, actually, behind his movies, although his movies aren't intellectual. Do you think he wanted to be taken more seriously as a serious director.
Yes, I think so. The critics couldn't forgive him in Italy for not making movies about Italy. He made movies about another country in another century, which were genre films, as you say. And the directors that were rated made movies about social problem movies about Italian life: Visconti, Pasolini, Fellini. And he slightly resented that. I mean, one reason why I got to know him a bit and got on so well with him was he was bowled over by the thought. Here was this Englishman taking his work seriously, writing books about it. He couldn't believe it. Here was someone who was actually running with it. And I was really a lone voice at that time. There was nobody else flying the flag for Leone. And he was very touched by that. He was also touched by the fact I'd done some research on his father, Vincenzo, and I found out things about his father and the films that he made, which even Leone didn't know. And he was very touched by that. But yeah, towards the end of his life, he began to be rated, both by the Italian film establishment and globally. But it was a long time coming. And they just couldn't forgive him for making cowboy movies, you know. I think the world's changed. People love John Ford, they love Peckinpah, they love Leone, they love Howard Hawks. There's a lot of Western directors who are now up there in the pantheon of great directors. But it wasn't always like that. If you made a cowboy film, you were cast into the outer darkness.
Christopher Frayling will be back in the second half of the show to talk more about the Westerns of Sergio Leone. His new book is called Once Upon a Time in Italy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including masterpieces of Western music, classics from the Baroque to the modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dial Press, publisher of Temple Stream, A Rural Odyssey, a nonfiction narrative that explores the Maine countryside, by Bill Rohrbach. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Clint Eastwood became the man with no name. We continue our conversation with Christopher Frayling about the Westerns of Sergio Leone. Also, Milo Miles plays music by the band Joe Strummer was in before The Clash. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christopher Frayling. He's co-curated a new exhibition about the Westerns of Sergio Leone called Once Upon a Time in Italy, and he's written a companion book of the same name. The exhibition, which runs through January 22nd, is at the Autry National Center's Museum of the American West. Leone's Westerns include A Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Once Upon a Time in the West. We've been talking about the Westerns of Sergio Leone. Let's talk a little bit about the casting in those Westerns. His casting is so good. Of course, Clint Eastwood is the most famous character in his Westerns, the man with no name in the Fistful of Dollars trilogy. Clint Eastwood was known as Rowdy Yates on Rawhide, the TV cattle herding series. What did Leone see in Eastwood, in the mid-1960s when he cast him?
Well, it was partly because Clint Eastwood wasn't very expensive. He came for $15,000, $16,000 in those days, and they had a very, very limited budget on Fistful of Dollars. But mainly, he wasn't the first choice either, that Leone had in mind Henry Fonda right at the, even at that early stage. He had in mind James Coburn and one or two other actors, but they all proved to be, and Charles Bronson, and they all proved to be either too expensive or they didn't read the script. And it has to be said, the script in its early stages, which was badly translated from the Italian, is a very peculiar read. We will go to the Hill of Boots, you know, that sort of thing. And so I'm not surprised that they turned it down. Then Sergio Leone watched an episode of Rawhide on 16mm in Rome at an agency and saw Clint Eastwood. And what he saw was this man who walks in this very cat-like, light way, that light Californian voice, the squint of his eyes. And the legend has it, I don't know if it's true or not, that Leone started colouring in the picture with some stubble and some rough sheepskin waistcoat, a dirty denim shirt, roughed him up a bit, made a lot of makeup. There's a lot of makeup in these films, a surprising amount by today's standards, to make him look much more dark and sunburnt. He wanted a sort of rougher character, and of course the cheroot, the cigar, because in the 1960s, this cheroot was sort of masculine and hard and a controlled person. So he roughed Clint Eastwood up a bit, and together they discussed the part. I think that Clint Eastwood is probably the only actor in history who's actually fought hard for less lines. That he read the script and thought he was saying much too much. It was much too talky. And he had these long speeches of motivation and everything. And Clint Eastwood just put a line through them and said, look, you can say this in one line. And so together they worked on this. But the rest of the casting is very much, I think, to do with Leone's photographic memory for films. You know, he remembered Lee Van Cleef. Hollywood had forgotten Lee Van Cleef.
Oh, tell the story of how he cast Lee Van Cleef.
Leone, for his second Dollars film, wanted someone to play opposite Eastwood, an older man, to play a colonel, a veteran of the American Civil War who is a colonel. And he wanted to cast Lee Marvin. And Lee Marvin was to play the part until the last minute, but he dropped out because he got two roles, in fact, in the film Cat Ballou, where he plays the bad guy and his even badder brother. And so Leone's about to shoot, the sets are being built, everything's green-lit, and he hasn't got a second lead. And he remembered from Hollywood films this bad guy, who was always the second bad guy from the left. He usually had one line of dialogue before he was shot or hanged or knifed or pushed over a cliff or whatever it was, and this was Lee Van Cleef. He had no idea what he looked like in 1965, because he hadn't seen him in movies. In fact, Van Cleef had virtually retired from the film business, having had a very bad car accident in the late 50s, and he just wasn't getting the work. And he was about to earn his living as a painter. I don't mean a house painter, as a painter of paintings. He's a very gifted painter, Lee Van Cleef. Anyway, Leone went over to the States with a suitcase full of cash, with a fistful of dollars, and arranged to meet Lee Van Cleef at a motel near Los Angeles. And Lee Van Cleef arrived in a long raincoat. And Leone was standing on the other side of the room, and he turned to his production manager and said, don't say a word. I don't want to hear what his voice sounds like. I don't want to know anything else. He looks great. He looks like a sort of evil eagle, a sort of this strange, always the bad guy, amazing charisma and presence. And I want that guy. I don't care what he sounds like. Sign the deal, give him the money, and let's have him over to Italy. So within 48 hours, Lee Van Cleef was on a plane to Rome. And the following day, he was at Cinecittà Studios in Rome as Colonel Mortimer in For a Few Dollars More. Extraordinary story. And astonishing. And Van Cleef has this wonderful face, which, of course, is another of Leone's trademarks, is extreme close-ups. And it gives actors in his films a huge presence. The black actor Woody Strode, who'd appeared in a lot of John Ford movies in the 1950s, has a walk-on part in Once Upon a Time in the West. And he said in an interview, that walk-on, which lasts less than 10 minutes, I got more close-ups in that 10 minutes than I'd ever got in my entire career in Hollywood, and everyone remembers my performance in Once Upon a Time in the West.
You know, as you said, Leone is so interested in close-ups, and his actors are shot in such an iconic way that if they're not already an icon, they'll become one by the time he's done with them.
Definitely.
And it's a kind of international casting that he's doing, because, you know, a lot of the Italian Westerns were had international casts. So
yeah.
So and you can almost see that in the faces. I mean, there's something very like an ethnic variety of faces.
That's true. And very often it went with co-production. You know, the Festival of Dollars is a co-production between West Germany, Spain and Italy. So you have Italian actors, Spanish actors, West German actors. There were a whole series of West German westerns made at the same time in the mid-1960s, where the Native Americans are all played by Yugoslavians, if you're following me.
Yeah.
So you can tell the Native Americans because they're Yugoslavian.
In America, they're all played by Jews, probably.
And, you know, you're quite right. There's this sort of ethnic mix. But I think, and in fact, in, you know, in Once Upon a Time in the West, Claudio Cardinale, Italian, Charles Bronson, American, Henry Fonda, American, Gabriele Fazzetti, the man who plays the railroad baron, Italian, Frank Wolfe, an American actor who'd moved over after the blacklist of the early 50s to Rome and was making his living in the Italian film industry. It's quite a mix of actors. But I think it points to another thing, and that is that when these films came out, they were treated as ersatz American movies, you know, carbon copy westerns which were trying to ape Hollywood. I don't believe that. These are Italian movies. I think they're really best understood as part of Italian culture and European culture. They were originally made, well, Fistful of Dollars and For a Few Dollars More were originally made for the home audience. In the 1960s, southern Italian audiences went to the cinema more often than any other audiences in the world outside America. Southern Italian audiences went to the cinema twice a week on average as adults. There was no television in southern Italy in the mid-60s. So all the cultural references are for that audience. There's lots of references to Italian paintings, to Roman Catholicism. There are bells and churches and monks and cemeteries and crosses and angels and the interiors of churches and the whole iconography of Roman Catholicism. I think one difference between the Italian Western and the American Western is that in the end, the American Western is a Protestant genre based upon a Protestant view of the world in the 19th century, whereas the Italian Western is a Catholic genre, you know, at that fundamental level, not in an upfront way, but that's just the visual references.
Where are the desert scenes shot in Leone's movies?
The desert scenes were filmed in southern Spain, in Almería, which is actually a slightly different colour to the real American West. It's very yellow and olivey in colour. But if anyone goes to southern Spain on their holidays, some of the sets are still there, remarkably. They were built so well that the whole of the town of El Paso, which is built for a few dollars more, is there in the middle of the Spanish desert. It's
Wow.
extraordinary. You're driving along and you come across this town. So, yeah, it transformed the economy of southern Spain.
Well, you know, because the casts were international, you know, we hear Eastwood's real voice in America when we hear the American version. But a lot of the actors are dubbed in the early Leone films. And you can tell they're dubbed. They sound like the old Hercules movies where everybody's dubbed. so that undercuts things a little bit, you know, because the dubbing is just so bad.
Well, it's interesting. You know, every Italian movie of the 60s was dubbed. It partly arises from building their major studio on the flight path of Fiumicino Airport. So planes go over all the time. They just didn't have the convention of natural sound in Italy. Everything was post-synchronized. Fellini, Visconti, Antonioni, all these films. And so the dubbing is not unusual. I think in the early Leones, because they didn't have much of a budget, the dubbing isn't very good. But I think the sound design of these films does have a quality of its own. The gunshots sound like cannons, and the cannons sound like nuclear explosions. Everything's pumped up on the soundtrack, and Leone once said to me that sound is 40% at least of the experience of a film, and that was quite new in the 60s too. So there are pluses to the dubbing as well as minuses.
My guest is Christopher Frayling, author of a new book and co-curator of a new museum exhibition about the westerns of Sergio Leone. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Frayling. He co-curated the new exhibition Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone, which is at the Autry National Center's Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. Let's talk a little bit about the music in Sergio Leone's movies. And the music was done by Ennio Morricone. And the music from the Westerns is so, it's just so good. How did he Marconi and Leone had vaguely known each other in elementary school. How did they hook up as adults?
Yes, they'd known each other in the 1930s. In fact, there's a famous school photo where they're standing almost next to each other, taken in the mid-30s. But when Leone was making A Fistful of Dollars, he had to choose a composer, and he rejected the composer that the producers had suggested and went to meet Morricone. He'd forgotten they were at school together. But they talked, and they concocted a kind of anti-Western score, you know, that whereas the traditional Hollywood Western had a very symphonic, rich score, school of Aaron Copland or Jerome Morris, you know, folk tunes reworked as symphonies, they wanted something that was much more hip, much more related to pop. So you get a Fender Stratocaster guitar, as used by the Beach Boys or the Shadows. You get whistling, which is associated with kind of solitude in the desert. You get a lot of Italian folk instruments, the maranzano or jew's harp, you know, doing, 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 and a thing called the argillophone, which is a ceramic instrument with holes in it, where you get doo, that sort of thing. So it's Italian folk instruments plus rock music of the mid-1960s, and it was an astonishingly raucous, noisy sound, which became a huge bestseller as a soundtrack album, Fistful of Dollars. And it's nearer Tarantino than Aaron Copland, you know. It's kind of, it's like a pop music sampler. In fact, when I went to see Kill Bill, Part 1, Tarantino's movie, I thought he'd stolen my record collection. The soundtrack was absolutely those kind of things. But it's raucous, it's of its moment, it's youthful. And it's not hooked into the classical tradition at all. And it works, but it's also a lot of sense of humour. It punctuates the action in a very amusing way sometimes.
And on the soundtracks of the movies, in the actual movies, gunshots are used as if they're part of the score.
Yes. In fact, concrete sounds, you know, it was very trendy in the mid-1960s to experiment with music in the spirit of John Cage, the composer. And John Cage famously wrote a piece of music that consisted of silence. And the idea was the pianist would come in, sit down at his piano, and there'd be silence, and the sounds of the concert hall would become the concert. So the coughing and the rustling and the sweets being eaten in the bag and the shuffling of feet and the rustling of the programme become the music. So all sound is music. This was a very fashionable idea in the mid-60s. And they picked up on this for the Italian Westerns. Morricone was very interested in fact, he'd been to a seminar with John Cage in the late 50s. So gunshots and whip cracks and bells and choirs singing incomprehensible lyrics. Mm-hmm. I asked the choir master about the soundtrack of Fistful of Dollars. What are you actually singing? You know, what is it? Is it Quick Get Back or We Must Fight? Or he said, I can't remember. It was just incomprehensible. They're just sounds, you know. And the human voice is used as another musical instrument rather than as a vocal line. So you get a lot of humming in these films. And it's interesting. It's sort of avant-garde music meets pop. And they're classic soundtracks. And they're a very important element in these films.
Well, why don't we hear the opening credit music from the soundtrack of the first Leone-Morricone collaboration, A Fistful of Dollars. And we'll hear those gunshots being used as part of a score in this. From the Sergio Leone Western, A Fistful of Dollars, the music composed by Ennio Morricone. My guest, Christopher Frayling, is the author of the new book, Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone. And the book is a companion to a new exhibit at the Museum of the American West, an exhibit of the same name that he co-curated. And the museum is in Los Angeles. We've been talking about the movies of Sergio Leone. Let's change subjects for a moment and talk about another hat that you wear. You're the chairman of the Arts Council of England. Now, in the United States, the National Endowment for the Arts, which I imagine would be the closest counterpart to the council that you chair, has been involved in a lot of controversies over the years about whether it should or shouldn't be funding art with sexual content, with homosexual content, with a lot of violence. Are there the same kind of questions of funding art that raise issues that disturb some people morally in England? Is the morality of the art a question when it comes to funding?
Not really. The structure of the Arts Council's a little bit different in England. It was set up in 1945, so it's 60th birthday this year, as part of the setting up of the whole welfare state, you know, the National Health Service, the public education program, and the Arts Council. And it was part of a kind of trinity of opportunities for a modern society. And the Arts Council is in a kind of no man's land between the government and the arts community and the public. So it's at arm's length from the government. It receives funding from the government, and it also receives funding through the National Lottery. But it's at arm's length. The government talks about the general policies, the envelope within which you're working. But in terms of specific implementation on art events, it is very, very important that there's a long arm's length between the Arts Council and the government. Otherwise, you politicise these decisions, which I think is very dangerous for the arts. And that seems to work pretty well. I think a big issue for the arts all over the world, and particularly the publicly funded arts post 9/11, is the relationship between faith communities, censorship, and the arts. I think it's raising all sorts of questions that 1960s liberals like myself find quite difficult, because in the 1960s we believed, you know, anything goes. Complete Liberty Hall is the goal we should all aim for. Well, post 9/11, you know, there's a different kind of debate about offending sensibilities, faith communities, and censorship. Now, we haven't resolved it. It's in the ether at the moment in the United Kingdom, and we're debating this a lot. But in answer to your question, I've never experienced any political interference in a decision of the Arts Council. And we've dealt with some very, very controversial material.
Can you briefly give me an example of what you mean by the question of a faith community and its relationship to whether art should be funded?
There was a play that was put on about 6 months ago called Beshti in Birmingham, in the Midlands of England, which deeply offended some members of the Sikh community. And some members of the Sikh community stormed the theatre to the point where the play had to be taken off. Now, that raises some very, very... It raises issues of public order. It raises issues of sensibilities being offended, and about, you know, where should a publicly funded body lie in that particular debate. Now, for me, the value is freedom of speech. And I'm not going to stand in the way of artists who want to, if the art is of quality and it's genuine and it's not meretricious or superficial, if the art is genuine and it's making a point, I would not want in any way to curb freedom of speech. But it makes you think about how the goalposts have shifted since 9/11. Faith communities feel much, much more sensitive than they used to about the content of art and are much more vociferous about expressing it.
Christopher Frayling, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Christopher Frayling co-curated the exhibition Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone, which continues through January 22nd at the Autry National Center's Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. Frayling also wrote a companion book of the same name. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a reissue by the band Joe Strummer was in before The Clash. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. By now, the well-worn story of a punk band goes like this. A bunch of untutored kids pick up instruments, learn three chords, and before you know it, are playing concerts and even recording, fueled only by raw talent and drive. But none of the enduring acts that emerged in the 70s first wave of punk rock were really like that, and one of the most gifted punk pioneers, Joe Strummer of The Clash, was perhaps the least so. Music critic Milo Miles says you can hear Strummer's rich beginnings in the reissue of his early band, the 101ers. Let's get a bit of rock.
Back in 1974, Joe Strummer called himself Woody, after Woody Guthrie. He looked to Bo Diddley and Bruce Springsteen for equal inspiration and led a headlong pub rock band called the 101ers. There wasn't anything quite like pub rock in America in the middle 1970s. The U.S. bands that played rockabilly, blues, and boogie tended to make them heavy or arty or pretty. But the UK pub rockers kept the roots plain and forthright, even crude and ferocious. Because Strummer is so associated with The Clash, it's easy to consider the 101ers mere throat clearing. Instead, the recent expanded reissue of their only album, Elgin Avenue Breakdown Revisited, proves you can't fully appreciate The Clash without hearing the 101ers.
When we pull up to the pump, that's as fast as
the obvious point is that Elgin Avenue Breakdown Revisited helps explain where The Clash got the accomplished, diverse music styles that fleshed out London Calling and Sandinista. But more interesting, the 101ers highlight what Joe Strummer gleaned from the Sex Pistols. Not just a more confrontational sound, but the way to write modern songs about tragedies, injustice, and today's headlines. There are some goodies on Elgin Avenue that Clash fans will recognize, however, such as this number, which became The Clash's Jail Guitar Doors. And then there's Surf City, written by Strummer but sung by bassist Dan Kelleher. It foreshadows the romantic role that co-leader Mick Jones would play in The Clash. But, no question, the 101ers were Strummer's band, and as time goes on, he seems more at the core of every musical operation he was part of, pouring on more fervor and commitment than a dozen ordinary musicians. His first solo project after The Clash has also been reissued, the soundtrack to the Alex Cox movie Walker. It's a pleasant, accomplished set of Spanish and country-tinged instrumentals with a couple modest vocals that sound like warm-ups for Strummer's final band, the Mescaleros. Walker is a minor work, but if you love Joe Strummer, you'll keep it next to Elgin Avenue Breakdown Revisited. I know I will.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed the 101ers, Elgin Avenue Breakdown Revisited. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Shillog, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
And transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the latest developments in the story of who leaked the name of former CIA agent Valerie Plame. And we'll talk about what it's like for reporters to cover an investigation that involves the press and has sent one reporter to prison. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.